Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Conservative editor, blogger, and activist Andrew Sullivan crossed the pond from his native UK years ago to embrace America with the conservatism of Barry Goldwater, Ronald Reagan, and Margaret Thatcher. Then American conservatism took a trip of its own to the Christian right and left Andrew Sullivan, gay, Catholic, old-time conservative, painfully stranded. Now he's out to fight for the conservative soul against the GOP's current big government, big spending, centralized power fundamentalism, and for the conservatism of personal liberty and constitutional order. Joining me from Chicago is Andrew Sullivan. He's an essayist for Time Magazine, senior editor at The New Republic. He's the man behind the hot political blog, The Daily Dish. His new book is The Conservative Soul, How We Lost It, How to Get It Back. Andrew Sullivan, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me again.
So I've been summarizing it, but put it in your words. State your case for us. What's going on that's got you upset big time?
Well, I used to think of myself as a conservative. I still do. And by that, I mean that the government should be limited, that individual liberty should be the prime goal of government activity, that governments should actually balance their budgets and act responsibly. I'm for strong defense and aggressive defense if necessary, but always with prudence and often with allies and making sure that if we actually fight wars, we have a plan for them and that we have covered every exigency. Those seem to me to be very basic conservative principles, and every single principle that I've believed in has been abandoned by this administration. On things like the size of government, we have a 38% increase in government spending in 5 years, a faster rate of increase than any Congress since FDR. We have the debt that the next generation is going to have to pay off has gone from $20 trillion in 2000 to $43 trillion in 2005. We have a government that has actually, and this is what really I can't believe, suspended habeas corpus, the most basic protection for individual liberty in America that goes back to 1215, Magna Carta, and done so permanently in a war that they say has no end. At some point, conservatives who believe, as I believed, as a Thatcherite, Reaganite conservative, this is not conservatism. It's not just a deviation of conservatism. It's an attack on it. And we have to stand up and retake our tradition back from these people.
You pin, ultimately, all of this on religious fundamentalism. Of course, in America, that means Christian fundamentalism, the Christian right. Draw the connection for us. I mean, these things could happen for lots of reasons, but you're drawing it back to the fundamentalist root. What's the connection?
Well, that's not entirely correct. I think a lot of what I'm talking about is also just old-fashioned corruption. It's old-fashioned abuse of power. Once you've been in power a long time, you tend to want to keep yourself there, and you cover up scandals or you bribe voters to do so. So I don't want to say that all my book is about that. It isn't. But I do think the core of it is. And it isn't about evangelical Christianity as such, for which I have enormous respect. It's what happens when you bring evangelical Christianity into politics directly, when you turn Christianity into an ideology by which you run government. Now, the founders are very clear that God should not be the basis upon which you run government. You actually remove God from the Constitution. They came from a country, which I grew up in, where church and state were fused, and they separated them. And the reason they did that was because they'd seen the terrible consequences of politicizing religion. They'd seen religious wars. They'd seen burning at the stake. They'd seen families torn apart. They'd seen countries where politics had become impossible because God was on the table. And they decided to take it out of government. And the paradoxical consequence of that was that religion flourished in America. The one thing I hope people don't misunderstand about this book and the argument that I'm making is that it is anti-religious. On the contrary, I'm a person of faith. I believe I'm a Catholic, but others in evangelical Protestantism, I totally respect and admire. And I admire the work they do. I admire the charities they support. I admire the way they live their lives. What I don't like is when that is fused with politics, when God and Caesar are merged into one. And I'm not the only one. As you know, David Kuo has this book saying this is this has corrupted Christianity. I think religion and politics should be separate for the sake of politics, but also for the sake of religion. And the corruption of religion by this administration and the use of it to manufacture electoral victories is blasphemous and wrong, and Christians also have to start speaking out against it.
You write, the use of religion as a mechanism for social order, as a regulatory scheme to keep human beings in line, or as a unifying principle to herd people to the ballot box is a profound blasphemy. And yet, the Republican base that we hear about all the time, the Christian right, has been very powerful, very active, very energized, maybe not in this election, but for a long time. You draw a fundamental distinction between your conservatism and the conservatism of fundamentalism. Describe that big fork in the road in the Andrew Sullivan view.
Well, I believe that religious faith is something that you believe when no one is watching. I think it's very hard to know what God wants of us. If God exists, by definition, he is beyond our full understanding. St. Paul points out that we see now through a glass darkly. We cannot be sure of what God wants. And so it seems to me very hard, although we can have scripture and we have our tradition and we have, in my tradition, sacraments, and we can try hard to understand and pray and understand what God wants of us. But it is hard enough to understand what God wants us to do with our own lives, let alone to have the kind of certainty to want to control other people's lives in his name. And that is what is going on and has been going on. And it's been a terrible diversion from the great American experience of individual liberty and choice and faith that is not politicized and not made too enmeshed with government power.
But pull the thread through that for us, if you would. And you describe fundamentalism. You say it is, in some respects, the nemesis of conservatism. Connect the dots, then. How does a fundamentalist view of conservatism, or how has it led to the particular policies that you're upset about? How do you get from fundamentalism to goodbye habeas corpus, from fundamentalism to the war in Iraq? Do you see a thread there?
Let me try and explain the best I can. It's a complicated argument, which is why I take a book to do it. I have a blog where I can write very quick things. And this is why, in some ways, I can't even do this on a radio show. The book is an attempt to show exactly how the fundamentalist psyche affects politics. Basically, a fundamentalist, as I describe him or her, is someone who thinks the truth has been revealed in all its totality and that his or her job is simply to accept it and then to enforce it upon the world around him or her. Because after all, if this is the truth, and if it's so vital, if your soul is at stake, if everybody else's souls are at stake, why should you not do everything imaginable to make sure that everybody else is corralled and persuaded or forced into believing what is necessary for their own salvation? That tradition in religion has gone on forever. You see it in the Middle Ages. You see it in Christianity back in the past. You see it now most prominently in Islam, where religion and politics are being fused in the most extremist way.
But you also quote Tom DeLay in March 2006, sides are being chosen, the future of man hangs in the balance, the enemies of virtue may be on the march, but they have not won, and if we put our trust in Christ, they never will.
Well, if you have that kind of certainty, if you've stopped questioning, if you will not examine your own premises, if you are imbued with a passionate certainty that God has empowered you to do what is right, then you tend to engage in radical things without suspecting them, without questioning them. And so you end up with a psyche that can go into a country and say, we're so right, we can impose democracy immediately. We're so right that we can even do immoral things like torturing people because our motives are pure. We are so right that we will spend whatever because our motives are correct. They don't have the capacity to doubt. And the capacity to doubt yourself, to question yourself, is a critical element of Western liberty. My view is also is it's a critical part of faith. If you've never doubted something, you've never really believed it. You've just submitted to it. You haven't allowed yourself to question something. And faith, for me, is a journey between doubt and faith. It's a dialogue within yourself and with others as to what the truth is. It isn't this acceptance of the truth and then the imposition of it upon the world and the claim that God justifies everything. And when you hear the president saying these things, he's saying something very alien to what the founders understood. The founders were critical supporters of doubt. They created a system of government where they separated out the powers so that if one branch of government was absolutely certain that it knew what was right, another branch would say, hold on a minute, are you sure? We disagree. Or then the executive would come in and say, I disagree with that, and the judiciary would. Or they would separate powers down to the local states so that they could check upon the certainties of the central government. So in the core of the American experience and the American founding was an understanding, a profound understanding, that doubt is not a threat, it's a great asset, because it leads to more reasonable discussion, it leads to more reasonable decisions, it leads to deliberation.
Mm-hmm. Andrew Sullivan joins us from Chicago, and quite a kind of ideological dust-up. In the New York Times Book Review yesterday, David Brooks, the Times columnist, came after you, ultimately sort of hammer and tongs, essentially saying, your conservatism of doubt, Andrew Sullivan, would never have produced the Declaration of Independence, and that if conservatives embrace the kind of conservatism that you're suggesting, they'll be perpetually at the margins of America's political life, not the place for them.
Well, I let rip on my blog today in response to him. The key person, I think, in understanding the American founding and conservatism is Edmund Burke, who was, of course, the great founder of conservatism, Anglo-American conservatism. There were two revolutions in his time. The first was the French Revolution, which he was appalled by and wrote his classic Reflections on the Revolution in France, which is in some ways the canonical text of conservatism. Mm. And then the American Revolution, which he supported, even though he was British. And the reason he supported it was because he understood it was a conservative revolution. That what it was about was reclaiming the liberties that these people had understood were their right from England and from Britain, and constructing a society that would never, ever engage in the kind of fundamentalist government that is now part of the Republican Party. Most of the founding fathers, I should add, did not believe Jesus was God. They did not have the kind of faith that the current fundamentalists had. They believed that Jesus was actually not divine, that faith itself was a process. And the important thing was, as I've said before, that doubt should be at the part of the American experiment. So not only is David wrong, he's wrong in the most fundamental sense. He misunderstands the very meaning of America. And the paradox of America is that because you set up a constitution based on doubt, what you had in the culture and life of America was this astonishing flourishing of faith, because the Constitution removed those dangers from politics and allowed faith to flourish in society and culture. I agree with Billy Graham. Mm. Billy Graham, when interviewed with David Frost, was asked, is this a Christian nation? And he said, absolutely not. It is a secular nation in which Christian people can live their faith. That is the conservatism I want to get back to, the conservatism of Goldwater and Billy Graham, not of James Dobson and Karl Rove.
I don't want to get stuck on David Brooks, but yet this was such an attack. It really got my attention. I mean, he agrees with you. He says that the country has descended into a kind of period of intellectual brutality. But he says, don't blame that on the religious right. That's Donald Rumsfeld. That's Ann Coulter. That's, says David Brooks, Howard Dean. And he's got you missing something fundamental. He says, this is a creedal nation. This is a nation born of a creed, the kind of city on a hill. The implication is sort of, Andrew Sullivan, that you, with your conservative hero, Michael Oakeshott, just don't get it. It's almost as if to say, go home, Andrew Sullivan. This is not a country you understand.
This is a creedal nation in its social and civic and social life, but it is fundamentally a constitutional nation. The president avows his oath to protect not a creed, not a religion, but a constitution. And there are many different creeds in this country, And some people have no creed at all. And they have as many rights as anybody who has a faith. And what David has been involved with in the last 10 years through the Weekly Standard is this alliance with fundamentalist Christians to redefine conservatism in this country. I think he's the outlier, not me. I think he's the one that has actually taken what's precious in America, which is its religious vitality, and pushed it into politics. You mentioned Ann Coulter. Mm. Well, you know what the name of her last book was? Godless.
Yes, right.
Godless. There you have Ann Coulter, who's using religion to say that anybody that disagrees with their Republican Party has no God. I'm sorry, but it's deeply offensive to people of faith everywhere. And I'm sick of being told by these conservatives and Republicans that if you don't agree with their politics, you have no faith. I am absolutely sick of it, and I'm not taking it anymore.
I want to turn to our listeners. From Cheshire, Connecticut, Josiah is calling. Josiah, you're on the air with Andrew Sullivan.
Hello. I'm listening to Andrew Sullivan and finding myself agreeing with almost everything that he says, but I describe myself as a liberal. I feel that the points that he's making about how the separation of church and state is something that is as important for the church as it is for the state is a fundamentally liberal position. I'm wondering in what way what he's describing, the focus on individual liberty, is conservative. It certainly isn't the conservatism that we've seen in the Republican Party of the past 6 years.
Josiah, not of the 6 years, but Barry Goldwater's conservatism and Ronald Reagan's conservatism, Margaret Thatcher's conservatism, that tradition, it is about. We have seen what I think is a poisoning of American conservatism through fundamentalist faith. Now, it may be that right now, the old battles, because my issue with liberals, the old battles, namely, I disagree with many liberals on, for example, the role of government. I'm much more libertarian. I want smaller government, lower spending, lower taxes than many liberals would agree with. But in some ways, that's the old divide. The old divide was between right and left. I think the new divide is between faith and doubt, or rather, fundamentalist doubt versus doubt-filled faith. Sorry, fundamentalist faith versus doubt-filled faith, and separation of church and state, and the fusion of religion and government. And in that sense, I'm happy, delighted to join with liberals in fighting this new strain in American conservatism. But it doesn't make me a liberal.
but you may have conservatives listening to that and scratching their head. I mean, you endorsed Clinton in '92. You backed George Bush over Al Gore in 2000, but went for Kerry with your endorsement in 2004. So in the American context, can you support
I'm not
Democratic
a Republican.
Candidate?
Mm-hmm. I'm not a Republican in that sense. I'm a conservative who holds to his principles, and the principles are small government, low taxes, prudent foreign policy. Now, look at the Clinton era. This is what Dick Armey recently said, another Republican who's disgusted with what's happened. In the Clinton era, we had smaller government. We had surpluses. We had balanced budgets. We had prudent foreign policy. We had an astonishingly, what I call in the book, a really small-c conservative regime. I think Clinton was a very good moderate conservative president. Mm-hmm. And if you look at fiscal issues, fiscal conservatives now have more home in the Democratic Party than in the Republican Party. That's clear to me. So I'm not that much interested in Democrats and Republicans anymore. I'm interested in the principles and arguments. And it may be that sometimes a conservative is going to endorse a Democrat. The other thing I would say is the following. That another thing conservative wants is to make sure that no one has too much power over the individual liberty. And that sometimes means that a conservative will support dividing government. We're not partisans. Real conservatives are not partisans. We will sometimes support divided government. I think the 90s were successful because Gingrich checked Clinton and Clinton checked Gingrich. And we got the best of both worlds. And that's why I want the Democrats to retake the House or the Senate this fall to check the abuse of power that republicanism has produced.
And yet you write at length in the book, The Conservative Soul, about the same 90s and the deep unease that many people felt right around the world, whether in the Muslim world or here in the United States, people concerned about what the sort of structure about modernism coming at them and globalization, and people desperate for a sense of values in a time when the framework of life was less obvious. Is it possible that because, I mean, you're gay and openly gay in a time when the values lobby has made that a much tougher thing. Is this Andrew Sullivan arguing for gay rights against the era of more conservative Christianity? Is this your personal problem in that way?
No, I don't think so. Although I absolutely support gay rights, but I support them because I believe in individual rights. I support the possibility of civil equality because I believe in the principle more generally. It applies to everybody. And over time, the American founding and the Constitution has revealed to be imperfect because it hasn't included everybody. Women were once excluded. Black people were once excluded. In fact, in the most cruel and vicious way, they were excluded. Mm. Gay people have been excluded. This is not a radical thing. This is including new groups of people within the constitutional tradition of the United States. And yes, let me address that question that you brought up. I think the globalization and the economic dislocation and cultural change does make people nervous. It makes people insecure. And it makes a fundamentalist faith that says you don't have to question anything anymore. Just give yourself up to this truth, this God, this unaltering reality, and everything will be all right. That's very appealing, but it's a delusion. You've got to have nerve. You've got to figure things out for yourself. Your faith is not going to be given to you on a platter. It has to be fought for every day. It has to be fought for with doubt and struggle and difficulty. And now that's hard for people. It's hard for me. But the alternative, which is to surrender to these charlatans who claim they have the truth and will tell you how to live your life in every particular, that's a mistake. That's where we've headed. That's what this president believes. That's why he's made so many mistakes.
Let me take a call from Willie in Hull, Massachusetts. Willie, you're on the air with Andrew Sullivan.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
We're well. What do you think?
It seems like an attitude of loss. When he calls himself a conservative, the world loses. They don't blame everybody. All that happened on Election Day is the conservative people didn't like what they saw from the opposition and went out en masse and voted. That's all we did. We voted. And you lost, and this is the result.
Willie, it's a rough line. Andrew Sullivan, it's tough to pick that up, but he's saying what I'm hearing there is don't lay this big framework of fundamentalist critique on us. We went and voted. We voted for who we wanted. Who are you to second-guess us?
In 2004, the critical difference between, it was in both elections are very close, was Karl Rove and George Bush's decision not to persuade the middle of the country with argument, but to gin up voters, evangelical Christian voters who hadn't voted before, and to appeal to them on very basic religious grounds and to get them to turn out. That was what won them those two elections. So this was essentially rooted in the kind of politics of certainty and fundamentalism that I have described. They don't try and persuade. They just try and rally the base. And that they admit this. They say this is their strategy. It is an attack upon democratic conversation. It's an attack upon the very discourse necessary. It's about a culture war, not a political conversation. And we have to stop it. Now, the left has also, I think, played a role in this, and I regret it. Their attacks upon religious people conflates most religious people in this country who are not fundamentalists, who don't agree with James Dobson and Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, and doesn't give them a place to go. So they've kind of forced them into the Republican camp. But no, these elections are won not because they won the argument, but because they organized a base based on religious principles. Mm. And the reason they face losing this time is because that religious base has begun to realize that they're being used, that what these people really want is power, and they're using religion to keep and gain and entrench power. And that's why we have to use the methods we have to kind of check it.
Andrew Sullivan, stand by. I want to hear a voice from that base. Joining us from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, is the Reverend Robert Schenck. He's president of Faith and Action. It's a Christian public policy organization based in Washington, D.C., president of the National Clergy Council, minister in the Evangelical Church Alliance, been a big voice in the political expression of the Christian right. Reverend Schenck, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Andrew Sullivan says Christian fundamentalism is poisoning American democracy. What do you say to that?
Well, with all due respect to Mr. Sullivan, who is a very articulate spokesman for his very narrow and peculiar, nuanced position, I couldn't disagree with him more. First of all, the embrace of what turn out to be nearly universal moral principles by the Republican Party has drawn in thousands upon thousands of new voters into the political process, and that's always good for our system of government. Secondly, he mentions evangelicals. I am one. And the entry of evangelical Christians, which Mr. Sullivan incidentally mislabels fundamentalists, has been a winning strategy for the Republicans since Ronald Reagan first invited us in. In fact, I moved from being an independent to a Republican because of Mr. Reagan's very welcome arms. Thirdly, in contrast to what Mr. Sullivan proposes, Christian activists are the ones who, I would argue, returned a soul to the party of Lincoln and the abolitionists. In the 19th century, the religious right were the abolitionists. In the 20th century, those who take their faith very seriously gave birth to the suffragist movement and to the civil rights movement, though it wasn't in the Republican ranks. But by the 1980s, the Republicans discovered this is a very positive engine for the party, and it has been a winning equation ever since.
It brings in a lot of votes, but Andrew Sullivan is saying it's based on a kind of worship of received truth that's at odds with thinking through the world as we see it. What do you say to that?
Well, I can't disagree more. I think we've had a very vigorous conversation in this country about faith, about moral principles, about the values that Americans hold. Very, very important. And I would argue, once you get rid of that engine, that dynamic within a party, in the Republican Party, once you excuse all those people, what you're left with is the only core that remains, for the Republicans at least, would be to go back in time, say 30 years, when the Republican Party was synonymous with country club. And that was, I remember growing up in the 1960s, Republican Party was in fact the country club party. Well, that isn't a very a good philosophical conversation.
Robert Schenck, hold the thought. Andrew Sullivan, Robert Schenck portraying you here, maybe you're conservative, but anti-democratic. There's a lot of votes here. That means people, that means Americans.
Yeah, the question is why are they voting? And on what grounds are they voting? They're voting on deliberative grounds, or they're voting on faith-based grounds. Let me also say I'm simply amazed that this person would claim the civil rights movement or the legacy of the abolitionists for what is currently the religious right.
Well, it was driven by Mr.
It was Solomon. Let me explain why.
Religious.
The base of this party, the base of this current party. Let's take the Southern Baptist Convention, which is part of the base of the Republican Party, was formed to defend slavery, not to attack it. Let's look at history.
Well,
Lincoln's party was not based.
Evangelical.
Lincoln's party was not based in the South at all. It fought a war against the South, which now dominates the Republican Party.
Robert Schenck, I know we have you just for another moment here. Andrew Sullivan says that using religion as a unifying principle to herd people to the ballot box is a profound blasphemy. What do you say to that?
Well, first of all, politics is all about what most matters to people. And over again, we can see that moral principles always trump economic concerns. And frankly, I think Mr. Sullivan is just wrong in attacking the character, for example, of evangelical Christians, which remain one of the most generous charity sectors in American society, even around the world. Same is true of traditional Catholics.
I just said that.
Well,
you're misrepresenting me dramatically.
Well,
I said exactly that earlier.
There, but what I will
as long as they don't politicize it.
Well, Mr. Sullivan, politics is all about human enterprise. It's what we do. It's how we organize ourselves. It's how we express ourselves.
No, it isn't. You're saying there's no distinction between politics and society?
Well, what I'm saying is politics is part of society. It's the way
we. Do you think Martin Luther King Jr. was a partisan?
There's nothing inherently evil about politics. It's the way we do business as human beings in our civilization, in our culture, our society. It always has been.
Andrew Sullivan, Robert Schenck, I do hear him saying if the Christian right bugs out of politics, then American conservatism is going to fall out of American political power.
No, it won't. It'll actually manage to restore itself and its own principles. Evangelical Christians are welcome within the conservative coalition as long as they subscribe to the notions of limited government, balanced budgets, and live and let live. I believe in their passionately their right to believe what they believe and to preach what they preach, and I would be the first person to defend it. But fusing it with a party apparatus, fusing religion with one political party, telling the other political party, in the words of Ann Coulter, that they are godless, is not true religion.
Well, Reverend Shank? You're talking about non-political leaders. I haven't heard any political leaders actually get up and say, well, with maybe the exception of a very few, but then they're outlandish.
It is for us, then, to do as our heroes have always done and put our faith in the perfect redeeming love of Jesus Christ. Tom DeLay, this year.
Reverend Shank, is that an appropriate statement for an American politician?
Well, first of all, politicians will always be saying some things some of us strongly disagree with. It happens daily for me. So,
do you disagree with that?
Well,
do you think that's appropriate for a Republican to say?
I think you have to look at the Republican Party as a whole, look at its platform, look at the way it's conducting itself, look at what, for example, the president is saying, and I've heard him say some terribly generous and compassionate things, for example, about immigration and those who are here and so forth. You have to look at it as a whole. I think if you start picking apart little pieces, I can find very cruel.
He's not a little piece. Tom DeLay was the critical architect of this entire conservative coalition. He created this. Karl Rove and Tom DeLay between them created this. I'm not picking some fringe figure. I'm talking about the central architect.
But if you go back to the Goldwater days, Mr. Sullivan, I grew up in a dyed-in-the-wool Democrat family, and to us, the Goldwater Republicans were cruel, insensitive, and cared only about one thing, and that was the profits of corporations and big money. And that was the image they had. If that's what you want to return to, then perhaps that's what you want to return to. But for me,
I
want a compassionate party that has a heart and a soul. And you can't get better than that than to put the transcendent moral principles of religious belief right at the heart of it.
Reverend Shank, I know we have to let you go. We're grateful to you for being with us today. President of Faith and Action, joining us today from Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Robert Shank, thanks for being with us.
Always a pleasure.
Andrew Sullivan, heart and soul and compassion, it comes from...
Notice how that argument sounds very left-wing. I mean, that's what's so fascinating about this, that the religious right is really about the old left in some ways. It's saying we want to use government to help people in large numbers. I mean, as President Bush said, if someone hurts, government's got to move. Now, that's why we've seen this vast increase in public spending. Now, Goldwater was about individual liberty. He was about restraining government. He was about letting people be compassionate and love and have faith and be charitable, but in the private sector. And that's the fundamental difference here. And that's why what was once the right has really become the left. And the ideology is no longer Marxism or the left or social democracy, but it's religion. And that makes it really a very different phenomenon in American politics. And the fusion of that with one political party. I mean, Martin Luther King Jr., a moral religious movement, never said this has to be one party or another. He was bipartisan always. All the great religious and moral leaders of this country have never integrated themselves into a partisan structure. They've always appealed to both sides and on moral grounds. And the infusion of and the Reverend Shank was very candid about this, the infusion of religious truth into one party to say the other people have no faith and are against faith and against God is really a new phenomenon, and it is not a conservative one.
Andrew Sullivan, we have a lot of listeners who want to speak with you. From Lansing, Michigan, Tom's calling. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks, Tom. Yeah. I just wanted to give Andrew a chance to respond to those of us who look at his arguments and say, hey, you supported George W. Bush against Al Gore. You supported the wars against the Taliban and against Saddam Hussein. Why shouldn't loyal Americans like me, who are more liberal, look at you and blame you and even your sort of more secular and reluctant brand of conservatism for the absolute mess that the United States government has found itself in? Why shouldn't we blame you guys?
That is you, Andrew Sullivan. What do you say?
You can blame me if you want. In 2000, I did narrowly think that Bush was preferable to Gore because I thought Gore was going to increase government spending more than George W. Bush because that's what he told me. I was wrong. In 2004, therefore, I endorsed Kerry. So, I'm fallible. I got things wrong. All I'm doing is saying I did get things wrong. This is what I've learned. This is the truth that I've revealed. I have to say, though, I've always opposed the religious right way through the 90s. I defended Clinton against impeachment. I wrote a powerful piece in the New York Times attacking the attack upon him in the late 90s. My principles have remained the same. I made one bad judgment in supporting Bush in 2000. I regret it profoundly. I tried to correct it in 2004. Now, the issues of the wars, I don't know whether we want to go into that right now.
Well, the Iraq War would be interesting because you say it's led you to some deep soul-searching of yourself and your instincts. You were a very strong supporter of the war.
I was, and it's not that I don't think that there were good faith arguments to be made in favor of it, and I still do. But I do think that my zeal in that process was something I regret and cringe at in retrospect. And I have said publicly that I am ashamed of it. And I think the only explanation I have for it is that after 9/11, I was gripped, like so many of us, by fear. And also I believed what I was told by the government about weapons of mass destruction. And I also hoped that we would have a war that could create a democratic space in Iraq and that we would commit enough resources to it. I trusted a president at a time of crisis and war. It turns out that trust was invalid. In my defense, I have relentlessly on my blog and elsewhere tried to make amends for this. But if that's not enough, then fair enough.
Was that your own fundamentalist streak somehow coming to the fore there, Andrew Sullivan?
Yes.
That was not concerned.
Yes, because none of us is. We're complicated people. Mm. And yes, I do have streaks like that. We all do. And in my book, I talk about, for example, how there was a period in my faith life where I think I absolutely was a fundamentalist.
But maybe it wasn't. Maybe it wasn't that. Maybe it was that American creed that David Brooks is writing about. Maybe you looked at Saddam Hussein and the tyranny there and said something's got to be done here.
Yes, and that strain of American idealism should have been checked in my own mind by conservative skepticism. I should have been more skeptical. Yeah. We all should have been. And in some ways, I learned that lesson. And this book is an attempt to explain and atone for that and not just to make a glib, quick statement on my blog that I'm sorry, but actually I decided it was my responsibility to myself and my readers to write a book that really, really tore at my own soul and my own arguments to explain why I was wrong and to try and draw something positive and constructive out of it. That's why I wrote a book rather than just keep writing a blog.
At length and in depth, and it's there. We've got so many callers. May I turn to another?
Sure.
From Hilton Head, South Carolina, Frank is on the line. Hi, Frank. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Good day to you, and I really agree with all your views. However, as a fellow English conservative who's been in the country for almost 40 years now, I feel that what David Brooks said about you, he also said, applied to me, perhaps we just don't understand the fundamental right in this country. I too was a Goldwater conservative. I was a Reagan conservative, and like you, I think Bush is just terrible. I think he has betrayed the conservative soul. I think perhaps it's just our European background which makes us think this way. What do you think of that?
Well, that it may help. It may help. We come from an English tradition of empiricism and common sense. But going around the countries I have on this book tour, I tell you, I don't think our values are that different from Midwestern conservatives or New England conservatives or Western conservatives or California conservatives. I think that there are many people within the conservative tradition, certainly in the West and Midwest and Northeast, who are totally like us. But the South has taken over, at least the core of the South. And remember, the South used to be the core of the Democratic Party, and basically it switched. And I think a lot of us are stranded as a result. We're refugees.
But let me ask you.
And it may be the Democratic Party is going to become again the party that the Republican Party used to be. They just switched labels. And those of us who believe in a moderate discourse, in fiscal responsibility, in limited government, have to find our home in another party now.
But what about what Frank raises here, a different perspective from the other side of the pond? David Brooks raises, you talk about a conservatism of doubt, questioning, asking, is this right? Should we go ahead here? And David Brooks says that way of thinking, the Michael Oakeshott school, would never have written the Declaration of Independence. It just doesn't have the kind of muscle of America's city on a hill, to quote Ronald Reagan, view of itself.
That's 1620. That's the Puritans. what the Constitution was in the founding moment was a very, if you read it closely, it's a very pragmatic, modest, conservative attempt to say, you're abusing us. We are restoring our tradition of English liberty here in America. And the Constitution itself, as I said before, is set up to make sure that the government can't do very much. It may be, and the founders did this, I think, because they understood that in reality, on the ground, America was indeed a fervent religious place, which is why its government should be riddled with doubt and should be constructed in such a way as to prevent that taking over.
The ultimate goal, you point out, nothing less or more than the pursuit of happiness. But do you really think Americans see that as the full and sufficient description of the American project, the pursuit of happiness?
I do. Well, obviously not everybody. We have lots of disagreements mm-hmm. in America. Mm-hmm. But a lot do, and a lot want to be left alone to pursue their own dreams. The Republican Coalition used to be called the Leave Us Alone Coalition. Mm. Evangelicals could be left alone by big government, and libertarians could be left alone by big government, and people pursuing their own ways could be left alone by big government. Government out of our wallets and out of our bedrooms. That was what we all had in common. And that's why evangelicals and libertarians could live comfortably together. But when the evangelicals decided, no, we're not going to leave you alone. We're going to take over this government and we're going to force our morality upon you. That's when it changed. So I really deeply disagree with the notion that America is essentially a fundamentalist, theocratic project. It is not.
Let me take a call from Bettendorf, Iowa. Helen's on the line. Hi, Helen. You're on the air.
Yes, I am sorry I missed discussing with the Reverend. However, as far as moral voters are concerned, what about the morality? Is it limited to abortion and gay rights? What about the immorality of the debt that we are leaving our future generations? Why is that not considered an immoral issue that's part of their voting?
Amen.
You're singing Andrew Sullivan's song.
I think that the most immoral thing you can do is to live your life and saddle all your debt on your children and grandchildren. And that's what this president has done. I repeat. The debt they're going to have to pay off was $20 trillion in 2000. Bad enough. In 5 years, it's gone up to $43 trillion. There's no way those people can afford that. They're going to be punished by this administration's recklessness.
Let me get one more call.
These people in power are not responsible, and they're not moral.
I'd love to get one more call. Mark from Boxborough, Massachusetts. Hey, Mark, you're on the air.
Hello. How are you today?
Well, what do you hear?
I'm listening to Mr. Sullivan. I'm familiar with his blog and read it. I think his attempt to disown George Bush and the Republican right is really an attempt by conservatives more generally to escape accountability. They want a mulligan. The problem isn't that Bush has betrayed conservatism. The problem is that he has acted out their wildest fantasies. The incompetence that we saw in Katrina, the cronyism of Abramoff and the Iraq contracts, and the immorality of the Foley matter, all of that is what you get when the people governing don't believe in government. And that's the fundamental message that Mr. Sullivan has written about. He says the mistake he made in Iraq was overestimating the power of government to do things. And it's that core belief that government should not be held accountable that I think shows the bankruptcy of conservatism.
Mark, our time is short. Andrew Sullivan, how about it? You're trying to walk away from a mess that you've got a big hand in. If people don't believe in government, including yourself, there it goes.
I can't imagine anybody listening to me the last hour thinks I'm walking away from responsibility for my actions or my beliefs. Yes, I think he's right in the sense that conservatives don't believe in government and therefore they shouldn't be running a big government because they don't know how to do it. And I think Alan Wolfe was right when he wrote that, which is why I think conservatives need to get back out of that and actually concentrate on small government. And I'll tell you this, there's no one, I think, conservatives doesn't believe that a government is not responsible for something like a hurricane. I mean, we absolutely are. And I would like to pare a government back to its core functions, policing, good public education, responding to natural disasters effectively, and doing the core things it should do rather than building bridges to nowhere or sending us to Mars, which is what these people, or recreating the world in places which is not easy to recreate. You know, you can call me those things and it's all I fine. You know, in some ways, you've been proven right. I've been proven wrong. All I'm saying is I'm certainly taking responsibility and accountability for that.
Andrew Sullivan, the new book is The Conservative Soul, How We Lost It, How to Get It Back. Andrew, thanks a lot for being with us today.
You bet. It's been fascinating.
Thanks so much for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.